Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What puts middle school students at risk for long-term struggles in academics, in relationships, or with drugs, alcohol, or crime? And what might we do to help them chart a course to success instead? An estimated 48% of middle schoolers in Dallas alone are considered at risk, a sobering figure for the future of North Texas. With that in mind, the Communities Foundation of Texas has made $3 million in grants since summer of 2012 to organizations working to improve outcomes for at-risk middle school students. Monica Eggert-Smith is a community philanthropy director with the Communities Foundation of Texas, and Rosemary Perlmutter is co-founder and CEO of Teaching Trust, which received $190,000 to fund its program to improve the cultures of learning, teacher effectiveness, and student achievement at five area middle schools. They join us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Ladies, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So why focus specifically on middle schoolers with this series of grants?
Sure. Well, a few years ago, our trustees looked at the discretionary funds that the foundation had to grant. And rather than investing in a lot of different organizations across a lot of different causes, we decided that we really wanted to focus in on a couple of key specific issues. So we did a lot of research, and we found that middle school was really an opportunity to invest where we felt like we could have a great impact that a lot of other funders weren't focusing on. I mean, we all know that education is such a critical issue, and there are a lot of funders locally that have been working in the elementary and early childhood space. At the foundation, we have Educate Texas, which has been working now for about 10 years to transform high school education across the state. But there weren't a lot of people really focused in on middle school. And so we felt like if we found the right partners, the right grantees, we could really have an impact ultimately on high school graduation rates by focusing in on those middle school years.
I was really interested to read that a lot of students who might be at risk for other reasons, but they've done okay in elementary school, and then everything falls apart in middle school. What's going on there?
Well, middle school is a time of such change for so many reasons, not just biologically, but the fact that you switch classes, you go into a larger, almost always go into a larger school environment. And there just is so much going on really outside the classroom. And so all of those conditions make it imperative to have the arrows all lined up in the right direction to nurture and protect and really develop those students.
And, I mean, are they motivated by different things in middle school than they were in elementary school?
The middle schooler has a whole lot of different motivations because they're all going through so many different things. But one of them really is relationships are fundamental. There's a lot of new insecurities that fall into place. And so making sure that you're building those incredibly positive relationships at the same time that you're pushing out very strong messaging around expectations mm-hmm. are both just critical elements.
Has middle school been neglected? It does seem that we look at early childhood education and we look at high school when it's sort of our last chance to reach students who might be struggling, and sometimes middle schoolers just get a bad rap, and maybe people assume that it's just a time to be endured.
Yeah, I think in some ways it has been neglected. I mean, it's a tough couple of years, and because the work in education reform in general is really tough, a lot of funders and education reformers have chosen to start at either end of the spectrum, mm-hmm. Either in high school or the early childhood elementary ages. So I think in some ways it has been neglected.
What do we know about is it easy to draw a line between performance in middle school and the likelihood that a student will graduate from high school?
I think if you're looking over the entire arc of middle school, that's really true, and mm-hmm. even the courses they take and the adult relationships that they form during those time periods, yes. Mm-hmm.
So adult relationships mm-hmm. are interesting because suddenly these students may be less interested in those relationships than ever before, but they're still really important. And yet many of them move into a situation where instead of having a couple of teachers throughout the entire school day, they might see each adult 45 minutes at a time. What can be done to foster strong relationships in these situations?
In some ways, having a variety of adults can be a very positive thing because different children are going to relate to different adults. And so that can be quite a plus for that age group. But that's only really so if you have a school that's able to really rally those adults around some common and consistent practices and expectations.
Mm-hmm. So explain what you mean by that.
Sure. There's a lot said in today's world, particularly with the conversation around school reform about culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that needs to happen for there to be strong student culture with consistent and high expectations, but also an equal emphasis on nurturing relationships, is adults have to realize that they need to be willing to make changes to create that common culture.
How did we get to a place where it used to be that America had a lot of K-8 schools and it had high schools? How and why did we move to a system where we break apart the K-8 experience so that after fifth or sixth grade, most students now go to a middle school?
You know, I don't know that I can historically answer that, but I do know that I've been around long enough to realize that as people began to figure out what size institution would really work well for kids at different ages, middle school kind of broke apart before it had really a well-defined identity. Hmm. And so then, of course, after that, they had to catch up and say, okay, we've gathered these kids together at their most sensitive age. What should we be doing differently? And it had to kind of catch up with itself, I think.
I was interested to read that one of the theories for why students begin to struggle in middle school is that had they been in a K-8 school, just as they reach the age where they would really be performing some leadership functions and be kind of at the top of the school, suddenly they're thrown into a blender and they're in a brand new place and they sort of lost social status. Knowing that we can't reconvert every school in America to K-8, and that may even not even be necessary, what do we do to allow middle school students to take on these roles, even if they're in a school where they may be the youngest kids there?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, our theory of investment at Communities Foundation as it relates to middle school is that it starts with great teachers in the classroom and great principals and school leaders. I mean, there's a lot of research out there that shows that if you have great teachers, school leaders, principals, student achievement and student performance and student leadership and development follows. So that's why we've selected grantees that we feel like give us a lot of leverage because they're really focusing on adults and providing the training that they need to work with this special age group of kids.
What does it take to be a really good, effective middle school teacher?
I think to be an effective middle school teacher, and actually this is a place where I believe it's very similar to being a leader in that building at any level, is that you really need to have, not to be repetitive, but you have to have that balance between results orientation, knowing where kids need to be and continuously nurturing and sort of driving their efforts in that direction, but also like really building trust mm-hmm. and building relationships.
So building trust, I guess part of that is allowing students to feel like they are respected, right? That they don't feel like little kids anymore, and yet they know they're not quite ready for, you know, adult treatment. So how does that work exactly? What does that look like in the classroom, in the hallways, in the offices?
I think in part it starts with high expectations and accountability. That, you know, that those are transition grades where students are taking on more responsibility and should be more accountable for their learning. But I think high expectations goes a long way in driving student achievement.
Mm-hmm. I would also add that it's a time when, because people are testing the boundaries, students are really looking to see who they can trust. Modeling behavior becomes extremely important. So it's not really as effective as we would all like to say, do as I say and not as I do. We really need to have adults that are modeling what they're asking of the students.
How different are the developing brains of middle schoolers from those of younger students and even of high schoolers?
Oh, gosh. I mean, we know that it's an extreme period of growth in the brain as well as, you know, in other parts of the body. But, gosh, I don't know that I know the answer to that, Chris.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know it's a time when they're certainly, in addition to keeping up with what might be a more challenging curriculum, they're also sort of trying on different identities and doing things that may feel to them more important than their studies. What does it take to keep students engaged in learning even when there are a lot of distractions?
I mean, I think this is where that making sure the curriculum is relevant becomes more important than ever because they are really in a place where they're not yet thinking about their post-high school experience are actually, they still have a long ways to go in school, mm-hmm. and they need to feel like school matters and that what they're learning is going to be relevant to their lives.
Mm-hmm. For teams of teachers that are working with these students, how much time do they typically have to discuss the students they have in common and the challenges they might be having and the successes they might be having? Is it common for them to have time each week to meet with other teachers on the faculty?
Yeah, I think that's one of the challenges, that there's not enough time. I mean, teachers are under great stress and pressure, and there's not enough time to really have those conversations. You know, that's one of the things that programs like Rosemary's are trying to do, is to carve out that time out of the school day so that teachers can work collaboratively to really design plans that will help each student achieve at their best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Monica's right. Time is the most precious resource in schools, which is not always true of every other profession. And so as a result, really making sure that teachers understand how to set priorities, that teacher leaders understand how to lead around those priorities, and that the principal understands really that, plus how to protect those teachers so that they can then spend time talking about individual students and their progress in a pretty frequent manner.
Well, priorities is an interesting word to use here, because with all due respect to the people who work very hard to educate our children in public schools, in private schools, everywhere else, sometimes it feels like in education everything's a priority, mm-hmm. right? Everything has to be number one, and it's really hard to work that way, as we all know in any job. So what does it really look like to set priorities, knowing that something's going to if something's number one, something else has to be number five?
You know, that's very true, and I have to say that the untapped, really, I think, solution set to a lot of really complicated problems is about teaching people how to even be conscious of what they're spending their time on. Time disappears in an eye blink, mm-hmm. inside schools every day, and if you're not really training adults and students, for that matter, to think very consciously about what they spent that time on and go back and look at their original goals for their students and themselves, then it's going to be very difficult for them to hit those high leverage activities.
And I think it's too about, you know, taking a 30,000-foot view and looking strategically at how time is spent and what obviously has to be done, but also, you know, how things can be done more effectively and efficiently, just like we would in the business community. In many ways, schools operate or should operate in the same kind of way.
We know that a lot of middle school campuses are significantly larger than the elementary school students have left behind. How can they be broken up so that they don't feel overwhelmingly large to new students?
You know, there's actually a variety of different ways people have approached that. Part of it is by pods and having grade levels in different pods. Some of it is in creating things that were often true in private education, houses, other types of advisory programs. I don't really think there's just one way to break it up. But again, if you're not really thinking about the quality of that time, even in those breakout groups, you're going to end up with a marginal solution. So it's, again, about really prioritizing the things that matter most and then continuing to bring those into the smaller units that then comprise the change you want on your campus.
We're speaking this hour with Rosemary Perlmutter of Teaching Trust and Monica Eggert-Smith of the Communities Foundation of Texas about improving education for middle schoolers at risk. This discussion is part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
grade. We were always in one classroom, and I could always, like, I had everything right there. I mean, I could just run I can run to the back of the room to get a pencil or something, or I can find stuff in my desk. But now it's just like it's like the lockers. Sometimes I think that the lockers has to be the farthest away from some of the classes, especially for gym, because I've got to, like, before lunch, because I have gym after lunch and I have social studies before lunch, and my social studies teacher kind of lets people out sometimes late, so I have to run and get everything, and so it's hard.
That is Catherine Sykes, a sixth grader from San Antonio. We're speaking this hour about teaching middle schoolers at risk with Monica Eggert-Smith, Community Philanthropy Director of the Communities Foundation of Texas, and Rosemary Perlmutter, who is co-founder of Uplift Education and the Teaching Trust. If you'd like to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I'm so charmed listening to her talk about her struggles, and I think we can all remember back to that. We want to ease the transitions, and yet at some point there is going to be that moment where everybody has to sort of grow and take a big step. Is there any reason why it shouldn't be sixth grade?
I don't know of a reason why it shouldn't be sixth grade, but I think the key is as you're getting kids used to a little more freedom and the chaos that comes with that, making it a very intentional letting go, as opposed to just everybody shows up and there's chaos and it's time for them to learn to deal with it.
You're on your own.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another thing we've heard is that a lot of students for the first time in their middle school feel unsafe at school, something they hadn't experienced in elementary school. How significant is that in terms of really harming the performance of students who are already at risk?
Well, I think it's critical. I mean, kids have to feel safe at school. Because if they're not feeling safe, they're not going to be focused on learning. You know, part of the investments that we've made are related to social emotional learning, which is a new buzzword that's starting to get some traction in the education community. But it's about meeting the emotional needs, the physical needs of kids so that they can focus on learning in the classroom.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Brett in Louisville. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Great. I just wonder if you could define at risk a little better. I think a lot of people don't really understand what at risk means, and also the impact of funding on a lot of these programs that help at-risk kids. I know a lot of those programs, in particular in middle school, were cut during the last budget cycle. So I wonder if you could touch on those things. It's like ESL, is, I know, in a lot of districts isn't even available for middle schoolers and high schoolers.
Yeah, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
So we define at-risk kids as kids who have significant barriers to learning. And that can be a variety of things. It can be poverty. I mean, certainly kids that are on the free and reduced lunch program, that's a factor that contributes to them being at risk. Kids who have difficulties at home, who don't have parents who are engaged in their learning. Kids who have just a lot of really tough stuff happening in their lives that make them at risk for failing in school or not graduating, and certainly not graduating career and college ready.
Some of those needs sound like things that can't possibly be met or ameliorated in a school setting. When you talk about something like poverty, what do we do about the fact that a lot of the problems that make themselves evident in the classroom did not originate there?
Well, you're never going to completely eliminate the problems that exist in society. I think the goal is to really minimize them and to really use every lever you have to try to replicate or create for the first time for those children what might be missing at home within the boundaries of what's reasonable for a school day.
And I will say, too, there are a lot of really great nonprofits that are there to help fill some of those gaps. I mean, it's not necessarily the school's responsibility to fill all those gaps. I think that would be nearly impossible. But there are some wonderful nonprofits in our community that exist to do just that. So I think it's also about connecting families and students with the resources that exist.
How available are the arts in North Texas middle schools? Is it something that automatically comes with a middle school education, or is it something that sort of outside funds often have to be raised to support?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think it varies based on the school. You know, in our community, we're very fortunate to have Big Thought, mm-hmm. which is a fantastic organization that is all about integrating the arts and creative opportunities into classroom curriculum. And because of some of the great national funding that Big Thought has gotten through the Wallace Foundation, Dallas ISD is much more ahead in terms of arts integration and those kinds of opportunities than many other large urban districts across the country. So I would say it varies by school, but in our community, we're very, very fortunate in that we have a lot of great resources that others don't.
How good is teacher retention at the middle school level? I know a number of elementary school teachers who love their work and say, I could never teach middle school kids. I mean, I know some middle school teachers who wouldn't do anything else. But is there a problem with keeping teachers in middle schools?
I think secondary schools in general, there is a challenge with making the job something that is feasible and attractive, making the profession something that doesn't seem insurmountable. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that this just really kind of sheds some light on the issue of making sure that the leader is aware of how to protect, preserve, and develop those professionals. And that's part of really why Teaching Trust has chosen to do the work that it does.
And we should say, in defense of middle schoolers, it's kind of a great time as well. Everybody focuses on the hormones and the craziness, but they're really coming into their own at these ages.
They are.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Stephen in Bedford. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to say thank you personally to Rosemary. You may not remember me. My name is, I'm Stephen, and I walked through with you through the North Hills School back in 2004, and you personally escorted me around that school, and my son ended up attending that school and graduated from it.
Great to hear that, Steve.
Yeah, it was great, and he's just now, recently last May, graduated from the University of Southern California, magna cum laude.
Fantastic.
So, very, very pleased. But he wasn't really an at-risk kid because that school wasn't really an at-risk school. But I know you've got four others that you are putting in at-risk areas, and the formula seems to be working because your results are just about the same regardless of the economic area which you're in.
Well, what is that formula?
Well, I think he's referring to Uplift Education. And so there are a number of charter organizations and traditional public schools that are really looking hard at, again, you know, tightening the culture of high expectations, continuously reinforcing high expectations for success for all students with no regard to where they came from, what their zip code is, what their socioeconomic status is, but continuing to realize that doesn't mean you take your foot off the pedal in terms of building relationships and personal, basically the personal touch in conveying those messages.
Yeah, I was reading an article the other day, actually, that, you know, the magic formula, well, there doesn't exist a magic right. formula. Otherwise, every school would do the exact same thing to achieve those kinds of results. But one constant that this study found is that every school that has turned around and experienced great success has had great leadership. And that's why it's so important that we have organizations like Teaching Trust that are really developing those leaders that have the potential to do great things in our schools.
For people who maybe have not had a lot of experience in school other than what they remember from their own childhoods, can you talk about the function of really effective leadership within a school?
Sure. So Teaching Trust, we believe that schools are really the unit of change for all public education. And within the schools, we believe that teams really are the lever of change so that no one person can transform a challenged school with challenged students, or really with any students for that matter. And as a result, you know, really creating small subsets of adults that are working very consistently along the same pattern and following the same roadmap is what we believe matters most. And it's the leader who needs to and often doesn't have the background skills to lead those teams to that tight culture and those high expectations that we know are essential.
So when you talk about teams, that's different from the world's greatest school principal, as important as that person may be.
I don't think you have great teams without a great principal. However, we do believe that a principal alone is almost too Herculean of a task, if mm-hmm. you will, particularly in secondary schools where the schools are bigger, to think that's going to happen. because of one individual. So they need to really, you need to create a leader who's humble enough to make their practice public, to try things, to fail, to continuously get better and strive for great results, and to develop others and know that really their success is entirely dependent upon others.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Hal in Dallas. Hey, Hal.
Hey, Hal. Hi, I'm calling from Dallas. My daughter is going to middle school next year, and I had this talk with some of my friends' parents, too, about districts. We're originally from Africa, and we have this bias about some districts. I don't know if it's true or not. Like, some districts are better, just like middle school, and I go with where is education good for my kids. Mm-hmm. So is it really true, like, the risk? The high risk is not specifically general.
Are you talking about like outcomes? Sometimes in suburban districts are better than in urban districts. Is that the sort of thing you mean?
Yes, yes. Like, is it true? Is it or is it just bias we hear, like as parents?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I really would encourage you as a consumer of education to look at the individual school. I think there are excellent school districts. There are excellent charter operators. I think it really depends on you doing your research on the particular schools that are in your community for your students and asking tough questions so you can get to the best choice.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that there are great schools, even in districts, that are really having some challenges. So as Rosemary said, I think getting to know your local school, the school that your kids would go to, is really key.
Another thing that we haven't discussed is that for parents who are heavily involved with their children's elementary schools, there's not necessarily a barrier to entry in middle school, but it's bigger, it's a little bit less homey and familiar, and sometimes that involvement starts to drop off. I don't know that at-risk students had highly involved parents to begin with, but can you talk about the need for parents to sort of, or community volunteers, to be in the schools, sort of shoring up the good work being done by the faculty and staff?
Well, I think it's particularly important for kids that are in an at-risk environment, for those of us in the community who care about education, to go to the schools and see how we can be involved, whether it be in a mentoring relationship with students or tutoring students. One, because as Rosemary said earlier, it's important for young people to see that behavior model, to see successful examples in their schools, so that they have something to aspire to. So I think in at-risk schools, it's even more critical for not just parents, but for the community as a whole, to get much more involved in the school.
Yeah, I totally agree with what Monica has shared. I think it is partly about modeling. And so it's really more about the type of volunteer hours looking different than it would be if you were coming in, say, to have lunch with a primary school student. Your activities may be different, but the need is just as great or greater.
What is the best way to make learning seem cool to middle schoolers? Maybe it's the first time where getting straight A's is viewed by one's peers as not very desirable.
I think it takes a lot of consistent messaging, and this is where, again, I go back to adults in the building have to be willing to row in the same direction so that the messages are so compelling and consistent that they overcome the wide variety of different voices that might be suggesting a whole lot of different things mm-hmm. at the middle school level. And I think it can absolutely be done, but it just takes a lot of unity.
How important are extracurriculars? There's so much debate about this, whether they're a distraction from focusing on the academics of school or whether for some kids, maybe that's the thing that keeps them showing up every day.
Well, I think they're certainly important, but I think it does depend on the individual student's motivations. For some kids, you know, they go to school because they love their extracurriculars and know that they have to get good grades in order to be able to participate. And in other cases, it does not resonate with kids. There are some great after-school programs and some great extracurricular activities, but I think it's a different formula, probably for every student.
Are there patterns of behavior that start to show up in middle school that are major red flags, maybe that don't show up in elementary school? I don't know, school absences, that sort of thing?
I was just thinking about school absences. I mean, students start pushing their buttons at home as well as at school. And so sometimes families don't respond with as much consistency as we're describing. And you start to see patterns develop in terms of not showing up for class or being late for class or, of course, being ill-prepared for class.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important point that, you know, when we make grants, part of what we measure is not just about test scores and classroom grades. I mean, some of the grants that we make, they're looking for decreases in disciplinary issues, increases in attendance, things like that, that ultimately show that the student is more engaged. So it's certainly not just about test scores.
Are there ever surprises, consequences, even benefits that you didn't expect coming from a particular kind of program that you funded?
You know, we've seen some really neat collaborations by just getting all of our grantees in the same room. Many of them have been working together for several years, but some of them had not. And so just giving them each an opportunity to tell about the program that we are funding through Communities Foundation of Texas sparks some ideas and some opportunities for them to work together that wouldn't have existed before. So I think it's an ongoing dialogue, and we've been pleasantly surprised to see how many of our grantees have actually come together to do things in new and innovative ways that we hadn't anticipated.
Has that affected you all at Teaching Trust?
Well, I was just thinking about that. Really, there is very little time when you're in a nonprofit to stop and network with those individuals that are doing complementary work. And so the funders like Communities Foundation that are willing to take the time to make that happen are really able to help all of us go further together. It's pretty critical.
We're speaking this hour with Rosemary Perlmutter of Teaching Trust and Monica Eggert-Smith of the Communities Foundation of Texas. They are both working to improve education for at-risk middle schoolers. This conversation is part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
A lot of people are bustling around, but also people just stand there and then you try to get them to move, or you just push through them. And sometimes you see people holding hands, hugging, or sometimes making out, which is kind of scary. People suddenly felt mature and needed a boyfriend or first kiss. I really don't like dating, but I have a lot of guy friends, and people have a boyfriend or girlfriend. I don't really have an opinion on it. Just don't make out in front of me.
That was Quincy Trong, an eighth grader from Allen, speaking about the hormonal surges that happen in middle school. We're speaking about at-risk middle school education today with Monica Eggert-Smith of the Communities Foundation of Texas and Rosemary Perlmutter of Teaching Trust. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Of course, the men and women who have dedicated their lives to educating middle schoolers don't want to feel like, part-time police officers, but there's some of that has to go on in these schools. How do you appropriately handle discipline when it's not issues of absolute safety, but it is, you know, keeping students focused on what they're there to do?
You know, I think really discipline needs to be something that's not reactive and only pops up when safety occurs. I think it's about creating community standards and giving the students a chance to realize that standards are there to guide a whole series of activities that fall on both sides of them and to provoke conversations and really to be kind of tightened and examined and held up in a continual way, even when there's those dips in behavior that, you know, are forgivable but happen along the way.
Given all the understandably high standards that we have set for students in Texas, is there room in the school day for a 15-minute organic conversation that pops up about something that is maybe socially or emotionally important but will be tested on absolutely no standardized measurement?
Well, I think there has to be because it's, you know, those issues will pop up. They're of importance to the students, and it relates to what we've been talking about in terms of building a trusted relationship with an adult, that you can have those kinds of conversations. I mean, that's part of the learning process. While it doesn't necessarily relate to academics or test scores, I think it is critical that students feel like they can have those kinds of conversations and that we find time to be able to answer those questions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A comment and a question. I've had some experience with charter schools here in Dallas, and the parents line up to get their kids into it. And the big thing I noticed was discipline. Very disciplined, not so much as acting out, but just disciplined to learn. given this, what about the idea of parent choice and giving parents the freedom to select whatever school they think is going to be best for their kid? You had that woman call earlier. She's willing to move just about anywhere for her kids. Some people don't have that option. What about school choice?
Thanks for your call.
You know, I think that, as we've mentioned before, and I mean this sincerely as somebody who has spent quite a bit of time living with and working with school choice, that at the same time that we need to look at making sure that your choices aren't constricted by your zip code, which I believe, you also need to realize that extraordinary choices can occur inside of traditional districts. And very large number of students are inside those districts, and it's part of why Teaching Trust has really focused on being agnostic to the architectural structure behind the school system and really focusing on how to have more great schools.
Yeah, I would say the same from a funding perspective. I mean, we are all about making sure that every school and every classroom is effective. And we're not involved in the debate about school choice. We just really want to see every school and every student have the opportunities to succeed, whether they're at a public school, a private school, a charter school. We just feel like it's critically important for all students to have those same kinds of great opportunities.
So when Communities Foundation of Texas makes a grant, is the idea that you will get a fledgling or successful project, you know, sort of infuse it with some cash, assuming that it will become self-sustaining down the line?
Yeah, this set of grants in particular is really about providing some seed funding for some innovative programs and practices that either haven't been tried before in North Texas, or are great ideas by trusted partners with great track records that need a little bit of capital in order to give them an opportunity to prove up their model. So ultimately, the programs that we're funding through our middle school grants, we'd like to see be scaled and replicated in other parts of North Texas. But I think the role of philanthropy is to provide that seed funding to prove up some best practice models so that state education funding then can be allocated accordingly. But without that initial capital, we won't know what works. So that's where we see our role as it relates to these particular grants.
Well, it's interesting because I know that you're looking for evidence that there has been success, but it sounds like there's a little room there to try things that sound like great ideas that may or may not work, whereas sometimes philanthropy has been criticized because the way that you get a grant is by proving that you can do what's already been done before.
Absolutely. I mean, we hope for the best, and we've selected these grantees because, again, of their proven track records of success. But most importantly, they're all committed to measurement and evaluation so that we will know at the end of the day whether what they did worked or not. And we don't want that to be in a punitive sense. We really just want to learn from the experience. So if something didn't work, okay, that's fine. But what did we learn from it that didn't work so that the next time around we can do something differently that maybe we'll have more success?
We have an email here from Meredith who writes, I believe that middle school should be capped at 150 students per grade level. This gives each student an opportunity to join and be a part of a sport, extracurricular activity, etc., and build relationships. But in Dallas, we treat middle school as a dumping ground, and if you are not the best at something, you are left out. Does any of that sort of ring familiar to you, or can you understand Meredith's perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Dallas has a lot of different programs and schools throughout the city, but I do think it's true that making sure that every student hears their name three times before they walk in the morning, that every adult knows where a certain subset of those students are and whether they are or aren't involved in activities and whether they are or aren't making peers and friendships that are going to set them up to have a happy relationship in middle school. Those are critical elements of the middle school time.
Saying their name, that's interesting. That sounds like it's about allowing students to feel like somebody knows who they are.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What is the best way to intervene when a student appears to be slipping? I would think middle school is a great time to catch that before it becomes irreparable.
Yeah, I think intervention requires, again, first the adults all knowing where the students are, mm-hmm. because really intervention is, it's incredibly helpful when it's one random person that's just got a heightened sensitivity, but it's even better when you have an entire school trained to be watchful so that no student can really fall out of step without multiple adults being aware of it and discussing it as a group.
Yeah, and I guess there's a difference between a student suddenly slipping in math but doing okay in everything else and a student whose grades have universally dropped or changed.
Absolutely. But, you know, as a parent, I know you will share this, you want to know that somebody is aware even when your student is faltering in one grade.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Tony in Red Oak. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
All right. Yeah, I have a question and comment.
Mm-hmm.
My first question is, when I hear a lot of people come on the radio, especially from the educational point of view, most of the people have these ideals, and it seems though they, especially for urban school districts, but my question is first is, if you have kids, or your kids are grown now, would you put them in the system that you are advocating now, as far as in an urban school district? Because most of the people that I hear are mostly white, and they mean well. Nothing wrong with that. And then my comment is that we know by facts that most whites put their kids in private school, and we know by facts and numbers that Hispanic and blacks put theirs in charter school. And to me, if you cannot convince the white step people to put their kids in charter school, you still have a segregation issue. And neither one of you are talking about that issue and part of the background and the environment issue. I'll listen for that off air.
Thanks for your call. Well, there's a lot that Tony put on the table there.
Sure, I don't mind diving in a little bit. So I would say that there are a surprisingly large number of folks from all ethnicities that apply to both magnet schools within a district and to charter schools outside of a district. I think that what you're going to find from a philanthropy position, and I don't know if I have any pushback on this, but I think that funders often fund schools that are in predominantly either low income and areas or sometimes communities of color, because there is a sense that they have not had as many options in certain parts of town as others. And as a result, you do tend to get a lot more, I would say, national or regional chains for charters that tend to go into certain communities because the need is there and the funding is there and they line up. And that might give an appearance that there is a predominant interest by one group or another.
Yeah, and I would say, too, that, you know, it might surprise people that one of the grants that we've made, actually it's a continuing grant over 2 years, is to the Plano School District that actually has quite a few Title I schools. And most people think of Plano as a very wealthy district, predominantly white. And they actually have a very significant population of at-risk kids that we're investing in six of their highest need middle schools. The demographics have been shifting, but that's a suburban district that has historically been thought of to be very well off and you know, not having the issues that some of the other big urban districts do.
So these middle school projects that are in place now because of these grants, in some ways, I guess you can measure success in the short term, but you can't really know until it's time for these students to graduate from high school, right? How successful they've been.
Sure. I mean, there are some things that we can look at in the short term. I mean, classroom grades, certainly, you know, test scores on the STAR exams. We can look at things like teacher retention rates. We can look at attendance numbers, disciplinary actions, things like that, individual student achievement and improvement over the course of a single year that will give us some indications of whether or not these programs are working and are successful. But you're right. I mean, ultimately, it is a long-term game. And we want to see these kids graduate from high school, not just graduate, but we want them to be college and career ready. And so we won't know if we are ultimately successful for a few years down the road.
How does measurement work for you?
You know, it's exactly what Monica just described. It's a long-term game, but we have to look at what are the interim benchmarks on the way. And so in terms of our oldest program, Teaching Trust has three programs. One is really focused on aspiring school principals, one on teams, and one really on what we call our fellows program, which is instructional leaders that are involved in basically making sure that their practice is high fidelity and they're influencing others and the implementation of policy there. And all of those programs, I think, they're measured by a couple of things before we get to student academics, which is the king. They're measured by whether or not our candidates get placed, because nobody has to hire them. Nobody has to give them leadership roles. So the degree to which they're being placed, the degree to which they're actually rising to the occasion and taking on leadership is a big part of that.
Are school districts doing a good job of recruiting the most qualified people?
I think that across the country, in urban areas that are pretty deeply involved in improvement initiatives, you're seeing talent management as one of the number one frontiers, making sure that they are tightening up. There's been a lot of work to be done, so it's still an early effort. But I think that there is great indicators in the last 5 or 6 years that it's one of the highest strategic initiatives inside of every district that's trying to turn around.
So it's a specialization, in
Absolutely.
Other words, that's sort of growing. Should we feel good about the middle schoolers of North Texas?
Well, I think we should certainly feel encouraged. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think for the first time in quite a while, there are lots of wonderful organizations that are all rowing in the same direction. We've got a great education initiative locally called Commit that is getting all of our resources kind of aligned so that we can ultimately keep our eye on the prize, which is student achievement. So I think we should be encouraged. As Rosemary said, there's a lot of work to be done, and it's tough stuff. It's not an overnight fix, and there's not a magic bullet, but I think we should be encouraged by the progress that's being made and the people that are leading this charge.
And I wouldn't want to leave out higher ed, which I know has had a lot of conversation surrounding it, particularly in the area of preparation of educators. And I think that SMU here has just been an extraordinary partner in terms of innovation.
Rosemary Perlmutter is co-founder and CEO of Teaching Trust. Monica Eggert-Smith is a community philanthropy director with the Communities Foundation of Texas. We've been talking about improving middle school education today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. You can learn more at kera.org/graduate. Rosemary and Monica, it's been wonderful to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.